Chapter 35. Clerical work has never been my strong point, and after an evening of writing letters, it was a relief to trot down the stairs from our bedsitter and stroll across the marketplace to the post office. I had just dropped the letters in the box when a burst of jazz music came over the cobbles from an open doorway, and in an instant I was back in my bachelor days, back to the night of that dance when my courtship of Helen had been progressing badly. The big room at Scaledale House had been full that night. It seemed to me that this room, with its graceful alcoves, high carved ceiling and French windows, lay at the centre of our life in Derby. It was where Siegfried, Tristan and I gathered when the day's work was done, toasting our feet by the white wood fireplace with the glass-fronted cupboard on top, talking over the day's events. It was the heart of our bachelor existence, sitting there in a happy stupor, reading, listening to the radio, Tristan usually flipping effortlessly through the Daily Telegraph crossword. It was where Siegfried entertained his friends, and there was a constant stream of them, old and young, male and female. But tonight, it was Tristan's turn, and the pack of young people with drinks in their hands were there at his invitation, and they wouldn't need much persuasion. Though just about the opposite of his brother in many ways, he had the same attractiveness which brought the friends running at the crook of a finger. The occasion was the daffodil ball at the Drover's Arms, and we were dressed in our best. This was a different kind of function from the usual village institute hop, with the farm lads in their big boots and music from a scraping fiddle and piano. It was a proper dance, with a popular local band, Lenny Butterfield and his Hotshots, and it was an annual affair to herald the arrival of spring. I watched Tristan dispensing the drinks. The bottles of whiskey, gin and sherry, which Siegfried kept in the fireplace cupboard, had taken some severe punishment, but Tristan himself had been abstemious. An occasional sip from a glass of light ale, perhaps, but nothing more. Drinking to him meant the bulk intake of draught bitter. All else was mere vanity and folly. Dainty little glasses were anathema, and even now, when I see him at a party where everybody is holding small drinks, Tristan somehow contrives to have a pint in his hand. "Nice little gathering, Jim," he said, appearing at my elbow. "A few more blokes than girls, but that won't matter much." I eyed him coldly. I knew why there were extra men. It was so that Tristan wouldn't have to take the floor too often. It fitted in with his general dislike of squandering energy that he was an unenthusiastic dancer. He didn't mind walking a girl round the floor now and again during the evening, but he preferred to spend most of the time in the bar. So, in fact, did a lot of the Derby folk. When we arrived at the Drovers, the bar was congested, while only a dedicated few circled round the ballroom. But, as time went on, more and more couples ventured out, and by 10 o'clock the dance floor was truly packed. And I soon found I was enjoying myself. Tristan's friends were an effervescent bunch, likeable young men and attractive girls. I just couldn't help having a good time. Butterfield's famed band, in their short red jackets, added greatly to the general merriment. Lenny himself looked about 55, and indeed all four of the Hotshots ensemble were rather elderly, but they made up for their grey hairs by sheer vivacity. Not that Lenny's hair was grey. It was dyed a determined black. And he thumped the piano with dynamic energy, beaming out at the company through his horn-rimmed glasses, occasionally bawling a chorus into the microphone by his side, announcing the dances, making throaty wisecracks. He gave value for money. There was no pairing off in our party, and I danced with all the girls in turn. At the peak of the evening, I was jockeying my way round the floor with Daphne, and the way she was constructed made it a rewarding experience. I never had been one for skinny women, but I suppose you could say that Daphne's development had strayed a little too far in the other direction. She wasn't fat, but lavishly endowed. Battling through the crush, colliding with exuberant neighbours, bouncing deliciously off Daphne with everybody singing as they danced, and the Hotshots pouring out an insistent boom-boom beat, I felt I hadn't a care in the world. And then I saw Helen. She was dancing with the inevitable Richard Edmondson, his shining gold head floating above the company like an emblem of doom. And it was uncanny how, in an instant, my cosy little world disintegrated, leaving a chill, gnawing emptiness. When the music stopped, I returned Daphne to her friends and went to find Tristan. The comfortable little bar in the Drovers was overflowing and the temperature was like an oven. Through an almost impenetrable fog of cigarette smoke, I discerned my colleague on a high stool holding court with a group of perspiring revellers. Tristan himself looked cool and, as always, profoundly content. He drained his glass, smacked his lips gently as though it had been the best pint of bitter he'd ever tasted, and then, as he reached across the counter and courteously requested a refill, he spotted me struggling towards him. When I reached his stool, he laid an affable hand on my shoulder. "Oh, Jim, nice to see you. Splendid dances, don't you think?" I didn't bring up the fact that I hadn't seen him on the floor yet, but making my voice casual, I mentioned that Helen was there. Tristan nodded benignly. "Yes, saw her come in. Why don't you go and dance with her?" "I can't do that. She's with a partner, young Edmondson." "Not at all." Tristan surveyed his fresh pint with a critical eye and took an exploratory sip. "She's with a party like us. No partner." "Well, how do you know that?" "I watched all the fellows hang their coats out while the girls went upstairs. No reason at all why you shouldn't have a dance with her." "I see." I hesitated for a few moments, then made my way back to the ballroom. But it wasn't as easy as that. I had to keep doing my duty with the girls in our group, and whenever I headed for Helen, she was whisked away by one of her men friends before I got near her. At times I fancied she was looking over at me, but I couldn't be sure. The only thing I knew for certain was that I wasn't enjoying myself anymore. The magic and gaiety had gone, and I felt a rising misery at the thought that this was going to be another of my frustrating contacts with Helen, when all I could do was look at her hopelessly. Only this time was worse. I hadn't even spoken to her. I was almost relieved when the manager came and told me there was a call for me. I went to the phone and spoke to Mrs. Hall. There was a bitch in trouble, whelping, so I had to go. I looked at my watch. After midnight. So that was the end of the dance for me. I stood for a moment listening to the muffled thudding from the dance floor, then slowly pulled on my coat before going in to say goodbye to Tristan's friends. I exchanged a few words with them, waved, then turned back and pushed the swing door open. Helen was standing there, about a foot away from me. Her hand was on the door too. I didn't wonder whether she was going in or out, but stared dumbly into her smiling blue eyes.
"Leaving already, Jim?"
she said.
Yes, I've got a call, I'm afraid."
"Oh, what a shame. I hope it's nothing very serious."
I opened my mouth to speak, but her dark beauty and the very nearness of her suddenly filled my world, and a wave of hopeless longing swept over and submerged me. I slid my hand a few inches down the door and gripped hers as a drowning man might, and wonderingly I felt her fingers come round and entwine themselves tightly in mine. And in an instant there was no band, no noise, no people, just the two of us standing very close in the doorway.